Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1186, the Oswald Institute of Virology, part 5, Context. This is being recorded on May 16th of the year 2021. Before I get started, three quick items. There is a link at the top of each program description and each Food for Thought post on which to click for the following. First of all, there is far too much going on for me possibly to cover in a one-hour weekly program. Please subscribe to the comments, most of which are made by our contributing editor, Terrafractyl, that is spelled capital PTERRARACTYL, and also some substantive contributions from other commenters as well. Also, at the top of each program description and each Food for Thought post is a link on which to click to obtain the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my work through For the Record 1156 available on that. There is also a mini library of old anti-fascist books, which are fundamental to understanding what I am talking about here. I get no money whatsoever from that flash drive or from anything else on this program or on the website. And also, for those of you who find podcasting to be the most convenient way of consuming the For the Record program, sister station WFMU is podcasting the program, and there is a link at the top of each program description and at the top of each Food for Thought post on which you can click to get the WFMU podcast. Now, this program is going to be fleshing out. It will be overlapped heavily with material in For the Record programs 1183, 84, and 85, and we'll be presenting, in some cases, reviewing the political context in which the arguments presented in For the Record 1183, 1184, and 1185 are presented. Something that is fundamental to understand is the three elements of information that I presented in each of the first three programs. First of all, from an article from the Guardian newspaper by Ian Sample from June of 2018, any virus can be synthesized or modified, synthesized and modified from scratch once the genome has been published. Reviewing now. Advances in the area, meaning synthetic biology, mean that scientists now have the capability to recreate dangerous viruses from scratch. One more time. Advances in the area mean that scientists now have the ability, the capability to recreate dangerous viruses from scratch, make harmful bacteria more deadly, and modify common microbes so that they churn out lethal toxins once they enter the body. In the report, the scientists describe how synthetic biology, which gives researchers precision tools to manipulate living organisms, quote, enhances and expands, unquote, opportunities to create bioweapons. Today, the genetic code of almost any mammalian virus can be found online and synthesized. Quote, the technology to do this is available now, said Michael. It requires some expertise, but it's something that's relatively easy to do, and that is why it tops the list. And from an article in Organic Consumers from September of last year, 2020, by Alexis Bob Mayer, noting why bat-borne viruses are so lethal in human beings. And this is against the background of the Pentagon financing expensive research through the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which I have termed the Oswald Institute of Virology, and elsewhere, into bat-borne coronaviruses in and around China. And it appears that the SARS-CoV-2 is indeed a bat-borne coronavirus. And from that Organic Consumers Association article by Alexis Bodden-Mayer, and again, this is accessed in For the Record programs 11, 83, 11, 84, and 11, 85, as Boston University microbiologist Thomas Kepler explained to the Washington Post in 2018, the bat's unique approach to viral infection explains why viruses that transfer from bats to humans are so severe. Quote, "A virus that has co-evolved with the bat's antiviral system is completely out of its element in the human," Kepler said. "That is why it is so deadly. The human immune system is overwhelmed by the inflammatory response. The bat immune system responds very differently from ours to viral infection. Instead of attacking and killing an infected cell, which leads to a cascade of inflammatory responses, the bat immune system can starve the virus by turning down cellular metabolism. The bat origin of SARS-CoV-2 may explain the cytokine storms that are hastening some COVID-19 deaths." And that should be weighed against the background of the extensive Pentagon funding of research programs into bat-borne coronaviruses through the Wuhan Institute of Virology and elsewhere in China. And one of the derivatives of the first two items that we have looked at, both the Guardian article from June of 2018 and the Organic Consumers article from September of 2020. There was a cover story in New York Magazine of January 4th of 2021, and it is by Nicholson Baker, who has also written a book about the history of biological warfare in this country. And he generally, although presenting information, skirts much of the information that I have downloaded in various broadcasts on the program. However, near the conclusion of that article, he does present a very important element of analysis that really needs to be carefully considered. From that New York Magazine article, SARS-2 seems almost perfectly calibrated to grab and ransack our breathing cells and choke the life out of them. Perhaps viral nature hit a bullseye of airborne infectivity with almost no mutational drift, no period of accommodation and adjustment, or perhaps some lab worker somewhere, inspired by Ralph Barich's work with human airway tissue, took a spike protein that was specially groomed to colonize and thrive deep in the ciliated mucosal tunnels of our inner core and cloned it onto some existing viral bat backbone. It could have happened in Wuhan, but because anyone can now print out a fully infectious clone of any sequenced disease, it could also have happened at Fort Detrick, or in Texas, or in Italy, or in Rotterdam, or in Wisconsin, or in some other citadel of coronaviral inquiry. In other words, once the genome of a virus in this case a bat-borne coronavirus, has been published in an article, and the Pentagon has been USAID through various programs, including and especially Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance, have been financing extensive research into bat-borne coronaviruses, again, through the WIV and elsewhere in and around China, leading to the publication of papers with the genomes of those viruses in them. Those viruses can then be synthesized from scratch. And in the context of the biological warfare, this would permit someone in command of that technology, and the U.S. military is in command of the state-of-the-art technology in not only biological warfare, but AI and other things. That permits the synthesizing of these viruses from scratch. And that is an important element of analysis to be considered in the discussion that we are going to be engaged in. Now, why Pentagon and USAID, by the way, a State Department subsidiary that very often serves as a cover for CIA covert operations, including some of the nastiest. Why the Pentagon would be so extensively interested, so very interested in researching bat-borne coronaviruses in and around China is obviously past a point, a matter of speculation. However, any benign interpretation of that intent, and I think we can assume that officialdom in this country will, if they address it at all, which they probably will not, will attempt to present a benign facade on such research, I think that can be effectively dismissed. One of the many things about biological warfare, as we have spoken in many programs, is the fact that there is no difference between offensive and defensive biological warfare research. Biological warfare research is dual use if you are researching how microorganisms, either bacteria or viruses, infect, sicken, and kill plants, animals, or humans. It is the same research, whether you call it offensive, unquote, or defensive, unquote. And the extensive Pentagon and USAID financing of bat-borne coronaviruses in and around China, leading to the publication of papers which have the genomes of such viruses printed in them, permitting someone to then synthesize and or modify those viruses from scratch, that must be analyzed in the context of the full court press against China. Now, I began speaking about that in the summer and the fall of 2019, before the pandemic broke. Programs such as 1089, 1090, 1091, other programs dealing with the Uyghurs and the destabilization of China, most recently 1178, 1179, and 1180, talk about that. The person who was at the epicenter of the anti-China effort was Steve Bannon under the Trump administration, and even though he was officially shown the door from the Trump White House, he basically, as we have seen, remained in contact with many people involved with the anti-China effort. We have looked at the destabilization of Hong Kong, what has been presented as a, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, movement, really has comparatively little to do with democracy. The incendiary element that touched off the unrest in Hong Kong was a bill to permit extradition from Hong Kong to other countries, including mainland China. Now, this was precipitated when a Taiwanese man murdered his pregnant girlfriend and then fled to Hong Kong because he could not be extradited from Hong Kong to stand trial for the murder of his girlfriend. This led to the pushing forward of a bill to permit extradition from Hong Kong to other countries, including mainland China. And I, for one, support such things. I do not think that someone should be able to murder their pregnant girlfriend and then take off for Hong Kong in order to escape justice. In many programs, including 1090 and 1091, we have taken a look at the financing not only by U.S. intelligence cutouts, such as the National Endowment for Democracy, of many of the elements that have been involved in the unrest in Hong Kong. We have also taken a look at the fact that elements of private sector and the Azov Battalion, both fascist elements involved with the OUNB milieu that controls the national security establishment in Ukraine. They ultimately decamped to Hong Kong to network with the leaders of the, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, movement in Hong Kong. They were there courtesy of an EU non-governmental organization, and one of the fruits of that networking was the adoption by the, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, elements in Hong Kong of the glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes salute, which was the salute of the OUNB in Ukraine. It then was adopted by the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian police in the contemporary period, and then that was adapted to Hong Kong by Joshua Wong. We've also noted in that regard the extensive networking between leaders of the, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, movement in Hong Kong, and U.S. officials, including intelligence officials, Jimmy Lai, L-A-I, who is a major publisher in Hong Kong and who has an apparent U.S. intelligence operative named Mark Simon as a top advisor. Simon, by the way, officially denies that he is an intelligence operative, which is pro forma. His CD, however, strongly suggests that he is, in fact, an intelligence agent. He has an extensive background with CIA and naval intelligence, and again, his official denial of such a thing, pro forma, under the circumstances, and unprovable in that any covert intelligence operative is not going to have their credentials out front and in public. He is an advisor to Jimmy Lai, who has been a publisher who has generated momentum for anti-China demonstrations in Hong Kong. We've also noted that Hong Kong itself is an area that is volatile from a socio-political and economic standpoint. In the run-up to the pro-democracy unrest in Hong Kong, wages remained stagnant while there was a 300% increase in rents. This basically reduced 20% of the population in Hong Kong to a state of poverty. That is something that in particular, I'm sure, is a motivation for a very understandable dissatisfaction on the part of young people in Hong Kong. It certainly would make the mobilization of people like that using social media and propaganda that much easier. We noted that Milton Friedman, the late Milton Friedman, dubbed the economy in Hong Kong to be absolutely optimum from a free market neoliberal standpoint. Much of the representation in the Hong Kong legislature is by business interests, and Hong Kong has traditionally been an epicenter of white-collar crime. It is not difficult to understand why white-collar criminals would be particularly loath to get extradited to mainland China. China occasionally will shoot people for corruption, and there is no shortage of that in Hong Kong. Hong Kong has traditionally been an epicenter of various types of malfeasance, including the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, which began as an opium bank in the 19th century and has morphed into, among other things, a money laundering vehicle for jihadist money in more recent years. Certainly, white-collar criminals in Hong Kong would be understandably fearful of being extradited to mainland China. I would also note that the situation in Hong Kong might, I think, for purposes of understanding, be compared with what the reaction in the U.S. would be if China were behaving toward, say, Black Lives Matter in the way that the U.S. is behaving toward the, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, demonstrations in China. Again, many of the leaders and elements involved in the unrest in Hong Kong have been financed by U.S. intelligence cutouts like the National Endowment for Democracy and have networked extensively with U.S. politicians like Mike Pompeo, former head of the CIA, and eventually he became Secretary of State. He is a Koch brothers protege. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that leaders of Black Lives Matter were not only receiving financing from Chinese intelligence cutouts, but were meeting with Chinese politicians. On top of that, suppose for the sake of argument that Black Lives Matter demonstrators, who for the most part have been altogether peaceful, were doing the kinds of things that we saw in Hong Kong. They were trashing subway stations, in some cases derailing subway trains, throwing Molotov cocktails at police. And suppose also that some of those Black Lives Matter protesters were using, there is no symbol in China that I'm aware of that could be compared with Pepe the Frog, which became an icon of the American far right and then was adopted by the Chinese, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, demonstrators. But suppose there were something like that and Black Lives Matter began using that image. Suppose also that those same in part Chinese intelligence financed individuals and institutions networking with Chinese politicians began singing the Chinese national anthem and waving the Chinese flag at demonstrations as some of the pro-democracy, unquote, demonstrators were. They were not only waving the American flag, but singing the Star-Spangled Banner. This would be regarded as treason and very possibly an act of war in the U.S. and the vehemently slanted journalistic coverage of that, really yellow journal, that what I had called the yellow journalism peril, should be taken into account. Also, as we have noted in some of our coverage of the Hong Kong, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, demonstrations, some of the graffiti that were placed on Chinese buildings, basically used the term Shina, S-H-I-N-A. That is a deeply racist term that was minted during the Sino-Japanese War that was part of what became World War II. It began well before the U.S. entry into World War II. It really began before Germany invaded Poland to begin the actual shooting phase of World War II. But the Sino-Japanese War, which eventually became part of World War II, was the context in which the term Shina, S-H-I-N-A, was minted. It is not only a deeply racist term, but has a very severe connotation in China. When you begin posting graffiti that use the term Shina, you are basically waving the red flag at the bull, so to speak. I am synopsizing here, so this is understandably an abbreviated account of the unrest in Hong Kong. We have spoken about that extensively in programs like 1089, 1090, 1091, and we have also spoken about the Uyghurs. The Uyghurs are a Muslim Turkophone people, meaning Turkish-speaking people, in the mineral resource-rich province of Xinjiang. They have been the focal point not only of destabilization of China, dating back to the early 1950s, but in particular they have been the focal point of naked lying and propagandizing on the part of various overlapping fascist elements in the West and elsewhere as well, in the context of both the Pan-Turkic movement and the Islamist movement. Elements of the Uyghurs have been involved with Muslim Brotherhood-derived terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. U.S. troops, when they first landed in Afghanistan, engaged Uyghur combatants in Afghanistan who were fighting under the auspices of Al-Qaeda. Much of the propaganda that we have seen vis-a-vis alleged Chinese genocide against the Uyghurs comes from the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. That is an organization that is sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and ISIS and was branded as an international terrorist organization until it was removed from the international terrorist list in this country by the then soon to be outgoing Secretary of State and former CIA director, the aforementioned Koch brothers protege, Mike Pompeo. Overlapping the Islamist elements that have been involved in the attempts at destabilizing Xinjiang province through the Uyghurs are the secular pan-Turkist fascist movements allied with the National Action Party or National Movement Party of the late Alparslan Türkeş. Türkeş, during World War II, was openly demonstrating to have Turkey enter World War II on the side of Nazi Germany. He then became Turkey's basically attaché or representative to NATO. His National Action Party is an openly fascist, pan-Turkist political party whose youth wing, the Grey Wolves, is the Turkish component of the fascist stay-behind operation that was set up in NATO countries under the auspices of Frank Wisner and Alan Dulles. Perhaps the best known alumnus of the Grey Wolves is Mehmet Ali Ajar, who shot Pope John Paul II. We have gone into Mehmet Ali Ajar and the shooting of the Pope in a massive anti-fascist archives series for the AFA program 17 through 21, and we've gone into the Pan-Turkist movement at some length in AFA 14 as well. Fascist gray wolf elements and pan-Turkist elements have been very active on behalf of the Uyghur Turkophone Muslim population of Xinjiang, most of whom, by the way, are neither terrorists nor gray wolf activists or anything else. However, there is, in fact, and has been for some time, a fascist, both a secular, pan-Turkist fascist element in the Uyghurs, and also an Islamist Muslim Brotherhood associated terrorist element within the Uyghurs as well. The International Institute of Islamic Thought, closely aligned with New Lines, the New Lines Institute, as we looked at, and for the record, 1178, 1179, and 1180, was not only one of the institutions that was raided in the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. It also was an institution which was associated with Sami al-Aryan, the investigation into whom led to the Operation Green Quest raids, and that same investigation was basically swept under the rug by then FBI Director Robert Mueller. The destabilization of Xinjiang province and China in general has also been amplified and distributed by, once again, elements associated with Ukrainian fascism. We have looked at some length at Adrian Zenz, last name is Z-E-N-Z. He is a far-right end times Christian who has been the go-to source for much of the distorted and frankly propagandized misinformation, really disinformation. It is deliberate distortion vis-a-vis Xinjiang province and the Uyghurs. In addition to being a doctrinaire end times Christian who is anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-feminist, Adrian Zenz also feels that ultimately Jews who do not convert to Christianity are going to be, basically consumed in the end times conflagration, which will soon be upon us. In terms of historical fascist organizations, Zenz is a member of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, which is an outgrowth of the Captive Nations Committee. That is a direct offshoot of the OUNB, Ukrainian Fascist Organization, that was christened by Lev Dobryansky, a member of the OUNB milieu, and also Yaroslav Stetsko. You'll see that variously transliterated as S-T-E-S-K-O or S-T-E-Z-K-O. Stetsko was the head of the World War II Ukrainian collaborationist government that worked alongside Nazi Germany and participated not only in genocide against the Jews and against ethnic Russians, but also visited massive and horrific bloody genocidal actions against Polish people within Ukraine as well. Sort of a war within a war was the Polish-Ukrainian War during World War II. Again, the OUNB milieu perpetrated horrendous atrocities against the Polish population during World War II, and that Polish-Ukrainian War, genocidal in a fundamental way, was perpetrated by the forces under the command of Yaroslav Stetsko and Stefan Bandera, again acting in collaboration with Nazi Germany. Ultimately, the OUNB became the dominant element in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations that began during World War II as the Committee of Subjugated Nations, so named and so christened by none other than Adolf Hitler. That became the ABN, that is to say, and the OUNB became primary elements not only of the former World Anti-Communist League, but of the Republican Party's Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council as well. Adrian Zenz, who has been the go-to person for U.S. and world media as well to a disturbing extent, is, again, someone who derives his gravitas from the Captive Nations Committee, an offshoot of the OUNB, and an offshoot of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Yet another element that is prominent in the destabilization of China and the naked propagandizing of the situation in Xinjiang province vis-a-vis the Uyghurs is the Falun Gong cult. That is a fascist mind control cult that is very, very well funded, I should say, and has extensive connections to not only the CIA, but other elements in the U.S. and worldwide. It has, as we looked at in For the Record Program 1180, strong connections to the Raoul Wallenberg Center in Canada, and Amelia Pang, who actually penned an op-ed column for the New York Times, again talking about the, quote, genocide, unquote, against the Uyghurs, also was heavily involved with Falun Gong. Falun Gong is very much a part of the Trump machine and closely allied with Steve Bannon. Again, closely allied with the CIA as well. And I think in terms of understanding just how far gone we have gotten at this point in time, Falun Gong is, as we have looked at in a number of different programs, it is a fascist mind control cult whose head, Master Li Hongzhi, not only is believed by his followers to be able to levitate and walk through walls, but also is believed to be able to install an actual physical swastika in the abdomen of followers, or law wheel. That is what Falun, F-A-L-U-N, means. And that physical swastika is said to be able to alternately revolve in clockwise or counterclockwise directions, thereby relieving followers of Master Li Hongzhi of various spiritual and physical ills. The followers of Falun Gong view mixed race children, feminists, gays and others as ultimately doomed to damnation. They view rock and roll music as, again, a symptom of spiritual corruption and evil. And they feel that computers and airplanes and other modern inventions are the result of miniature space aliens inhabiting human bodies and producing computers and airplanes. And it is, at one level, utterly terrifying to think that an institution like that could achieve such gravitas in the world today, let alone be a major vehicle for propagandizing about China. It should be, as I observed in a previous program, something that Falun Gong should be a subject for Saturday morning kids television. Literally, instead of being something that is featured in the Raoul Wallenberg Center, something that is allied with the State Department and getting major distribution and things like, I should say allied with the CIA, and something that is getting major distribution vis-a-vis the New York Times op-ed page, even as the news coverage of the New York Times, as badly slanted as it has been vis-a-vis China, is correctly citing Falun Gong as a far-right propaganda element associated with Donald Trump. It should be the folklore, it should be the subject of a Saturday morning kids cartoon show, something like, well, boys and girls, don't go away, because coming up right now is the Falun Gong show, starring Master Li Hongzhi, you know. Hi, kids. Hi, Master Li Hongzhi. Okay, well, let's get started. First, we take the magic swastika, and we install it in your little tum-tum tummies. One for you, Bobby, zoop, and one for you, Sally, boop. And now we make them turn one way, and we make them turn the other. Doesn't that tickle the boys and girls? It sure does, Master Li Hongzhi. Okay, now we're going to have the miniature space aliens inhabit your bodies and create airplanes and computers. Oh boy, those space aliens and computers and airplanes. I mean, it obviously sounds insane. It should be the focal point of a Saturday morning kids cartoon show. But instead, this is the type of element that is being used by elements of the CIA, even the New York Times, the Raoul Wallenberg Center in Canada, to disseminate disinformation vis-a-vis Xinjiang province. The anti-China effort also is not only something involving covert operations, but it has really been the focal point of the trade war and some very overt things as well. And when we see the Pentagon financing of research into bat-borne coronaviruses in and around China, particularly through the Wuhan Institute of Virology, it must be seen in the context of the anti-China full court press. Something that we have noted, again, in this context, I'm going to recap some things we looked at in our last program. Again, an article that was reprinted in Consortium News, originally from the Asia Times by Pepe Escobar, China locked in hybrid war with U.S. Now, bearing in mind something that we looked at the end of the September 2020 article from Organic Consumers Association, about 2 weeks after the genome for the SARS-CoV-2 was published, the People's Liberation Army took over operations of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I strongly suspect that this represented basically an act of defense on the part of China. They realized that they had been attacked with a very sophisticated biological warfare program. And from that article Asia Times, reprinted in Consortium News from March 18th of 2020. For the first time since the start of Deng Xiaoping's reforms in 1978, Beijing openly regards the U.S. as a threat, as stated a month ago by Foreign Minister Wang Yi at the Munich Security Conference during the peak of the fight against coronavirus. And continuing with that, Beijing is carefully, incrementally shaping the narrative that from the beginning of the coronavirus attack, the leadership knew it was under a hybrid war attack. The terminology of President Xi Jinping is a major clue. He said on the record that this was war. And as a counterattack, a people's war, unquote, had to be launched. Moreover, he described the virus as a demon or devil. Xi is a Confucianist. Unlike some other ancient Chinese thinkers, Confucius was loath to discuss supernatural forces and judgment in the afterlife. However, in a Chinese cultural context, devil means white devils, unquote, or foreign devils, unquote. Guailo, G-U-A-I-L-O in Mandarin, or G-W-E-I-L-O in Cantonese. This was Xi delivering a powerful statement in code. Indeed, and I think not only is Escobar correct, but I think the People's Liberation Army takeover of the Wuhan Institute of Virology roughly 2 weeks after the genome of the SARS CoV-2 virus was published, basically represented a defensive maneuver on the part of China when they realized, belatedly perhaps, that they had been attacked using biological warfare. And again, with the state of the art of biological warfare, once the genome of a virus has been published, it can be modified, it can be recreated or modified from scratch. And when you have Pentagon and USAID financing research into bat-borne coronaviruses in China through WIV and elsewhere, leading to the publication of papers which contain that genome, that basically under the contemporary, with the contemporary technology, permits the stockpiling of a sophisticated biological warfare capability using those viruses. And I think the Pentagon and USAID financing of that research needs to be analyzed in the context of the full court press against China. And again, I began talking about that, the full court press against China, in the late summer and fall of 2019, well before the outbreak of the pandemic. Also, as noted in that Pepe Escobar article, Chinese media are now openly asking questions and drawing a connection with the shutting down in August last year of the unsafe, unquote, military bioweapon lab at Fort Detrick, the military games, that's the military world games in Wuhan, and the Wuhan epidemic. Some of these questions had been asked with no response inside the U.S. itself. Again, I suspect that there were multiple vectors for the infection of Wuhan and elsewhere in China with the SARS-CoV-2. I suspect that the World Military Games, which began in Wuhan the same day as Event 201, which we'll talk about in a minute. We spoke about that in our last program. We're going to come back to that. I suspect that the military athletes at the Military World Games, again, in superb physical condition, and thus people who would not dive or be too incapacitated from SARS-CoV-2, I strongly suspect that that was a vector. Now, whether they were vectored before going to Wuhan or at Wuhan, and how they were vectored, that obviously will remain a matter of speculation. One of the things about biological warfare, it doesn't take many people at all to pull something like that off. Very quickly, from the American Prospect magazine of June 30th of 2020, by Tom Squitieri, Squitieri, did the Military World Games spread COVID-19? And noting that in the U.S. contingent, it contained 9 public affairs officers and 2 State Department personnel, according to Department of Defense documents. And still more, contrary to the Pentagon's insistence, however, an investigation of COVID-19 cases in the military from official and public source materials shows that a strong correlation exists in COVID-19 cases reported at U.S. military facilities that are home bases of members of the U.S. team that went to Wuhan. Before March 31st, when the Pentagon restricted the release of information about COVID-19 cases at installations for security reasons, infections occurred at a minimum of 63 military facilities where team members returned after the Wuhan games. Additionally, the U.S. team used chartered flights to and from the games via Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Washington, that's Washington State, not Washington, D.C., was one of the earliest states to show a spike in COVID-19. I've also noted that the Shincheonji cult, a South Korean fascist mind control cult with a branch in Wuhan that certainly appears to have been a major factor in the vectoring of South Korea, that also may have been involved with the vectoring of Wuhan. And who knows, perhaps of the military contingents, plural, at the World Military Games, including the U.S. contingent as well. Again, one of the things about biological warfare, it doesn't take many people at all to pull something like that off. Another possible vector, an Internet Archive capture, International Workshop on Biosafety Lab Management and Techniques, November 3rd through 9th, 2019, Wuhan, China. This from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or as I have termed it, the Oswald Institute of Virology, Chinese Academy of Sciences, from May 9th of 2020. There may have been vectoring done there as well. Now, again, a couple of the items that we looked at last week. The same day that the World Military Games began in Wuhan, China, there was the Event 201 in New York City the same day. One of the participants in that was the former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, a woman named Avril, A-V-R-I-L, Haines, H-A-I-M-E-S. You never become that high in the CIA and leave completely. Avril Haines is now the Director of National Intelligence for Joe Biden. And I think her position and her participation in Event 201 is worth taking note of. Now, as we looked at in our program last week, the aforementioned Peter Daszak, the head of the EcoHealth Alliance, which again is mostly funded by the Pentagon and USAID, one of whose top advisors is David Franz, the former commander of Fort Detrick. He was one of those people who has been laying down a body of, I would call it propaganda, but let's say information that was setting the stage for the pandemic. From the New York Times op-ed page of February 27th of 2020, "We knew disease X was coming. It's here now," by Peter Daszak. "Disease X," we said back then, 2018, "would likely result from a virus originating in animals and would emerge somewhere on the planet where economic development drives people and wildlife together. Disease X would probably be confused with other diseases early in the outbreak and would spread quickly and silently, exploiting networks of human travel and trade. It would reach multiple countries and thwart containment. Disease X would have a mortality rate higher than a seasonal flu, but would spread as easily as the flu. It would shake financial markets even before it achieved pandemic status. In a nutshell, COVID-19 is disease X." And this, again, from the New York Times op-ed page that also has featured the likes of Amelia Pang from Falun Gong. Again, given the role of Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance with the world, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and with Xi Zhengli financing that research, again, with money largely coming from the Pentagon and USAID, being advised by people like David Franz, the former commander of Fort Detrick, leading to that research, leading to the publication of papers with the genome of these viruses within those papers, thereby permitting the synthesis and or modification of those viruses using contemporary technology, I would call it propagandizing by Peter Daszak, saying we knew disease X was coming, it's here now. Well, I suspect he knew damn well it was coming, because I suspect he was involved with helping to create it. And for all we know, he could be a mind control job. This is the age of mind control. He could be completely sincere in disclaiming something like that. He could be tortured to death and would not, unless the proper cue was given, divulge the information that, yes, he was involved with something like that. We have also noted in our last program that Peter Daszak is of Ukrainian extraction, and his father, Bohdan Daszak, was 19 years old at the end of World War II, and we asked the question of whether perhaps the Daszak family is part of the OUNB diaspora. When we spoke about the Captive Nations Committee, its founder was Lev Dobryansky, one of the main functionaries that has sprung from that is Lev Dobryansky's daughter, Paula Dobryansky. She is very much involved with the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. She headed up the Tibet desk at the State Department, and the OUNB has been very skillful in helping to train an up-and-coming generation of fascist activists. So again, I am not making the statement. I am asking the question, is Peter Daszak's Ukrainian heritage relevant here? Because we have seen not only the OUNB milieu dominating the national security establishment in Ukraine, but in the destabilization of Hong Kong, we have seen Pravi Sector and Azov Battalion elements operating at the behest of an EU-financed NGO operating there and hoping to mint the Glory to Hong Kong song that the U.S. Cutout Joshua Wong has been touting. We have also seen, through the aforementioned Adrian Zenz and the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, again, an offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee, we have seen those same elements active in Xinjiang province vis-a-vis the Uyghurs and the propagandizing of same. So again, I think it is worth asking that question. One of the things that I see as an important element of background analysis or speculation, and that is the information, really propaganda being developed by the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and organizations that were involved with the WACCFL, that is the World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation. That was the steering group which was to result in the formation of WACL in 1967. And in the run-up to JFK's assassination, they were generating propaganda about the KGB training assassins, including assassins who might operate in the U.S. This was then used to help effect what the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Bale Scott has called a level one cover-up. That is to say, it was the commies who did it. Even today, we're seeing a book published by former CIA Director James Woolsey using information from a Romanian defector who, by the way, conveniently died of COVID-19 this past winter. We are seeing the level one disinformation effort has survived to this day. I am asking, with things like Event 201, with Avril Haines participating, with people like Peter Daszak saying, yep, we knew disease X was coming, it's here now, and there are very serious questions about the work he was doing generating that research. Are we seeing something like the painting of Oswald Red, what Peter Bale Scott has called the level one cover-up? OUNB slash ABN elements were involved with the WACCFL efforts in that regard, as we have looked at in AFA program 15 and FTR program number 777, among others. I'm asking whether that same consideration is involved here. We will continue with some of this in future programs. However, we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1186, the Oswald Institute of Virology, Part 5, Context. This is being recorded on May 16th of the year 2021. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.